the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. My thanks to Mark Liskard, Carl Hesterberg, Eugene Kenny, and Anoel Rinaldi. They're voluntary subscribers to the PBC show. And if you'd like to support it and you're financially able, just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side, click the tab You Can Help. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. Our lead topic today is about the healthcare system, and your humble host has been in contact with it this week. I have been diagnosed with pneumonia, and so you may not get another podcast for a few days as I work on recovery. But I am so grateful that I have healthcare insurance. And this past summer, I was able to upgrade to a Kaiser plan from a Mickey Mouse policy. And just as an example, I got a chest x-ray yesterday, and my copay was $10. And if I had done that under the previous policy, I would have paid full tilt for it, like $400 or $500. So our lead segment today is about the sick healthcare system in this country. The mad-as-hell doctors rolled through my town of San Rafael over the weekend. And you'll hear Dr. Paul Hochfeld from Oregon articulate the truth about why 70% oppose the health care reform, the health insurance reform that was passed in the last year and a half. Also, you'll hear Marin County Supervisor Susan Adams. She's a health care professional from the nursing profession with a PhD. State Senator Mark Leno of California, who continues to carry single-payer legislation, and he's in for a long-term battle there. And our friend Will Durst joined the Mad as Hell Doctors, and he's got a few comments for you. Our music of the moment from the late John Lee Hooker. It's called The Healer. Work on me, John, work on me. Our second segment today features Gwendolyn Mink, an expert on poverty in America. And a recent study showed that another 4 million people fell below the poverty line in the last year. And their plight is off the media radar. We get coverage of Lindsay Lohan, but not poverty-stricken American families struggling. And our final blast is from Gary Chu, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show. He reviews the new Oliver Stone flick, Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps.
The Mad as Hell Doctors are on the road, and they've made a pit stop here in San Rafael, California, just north of San Francisco. Paul Hochfeld is here, and he's from Corvallis, Oregon. What kind of doctor are you, Paul?
I'm an emergency physician.
Yeah. So how do we get back on track to single payer? Because at this point, we have Democrats running away even from the modest health insurance reform, which I think went sideways. And there doesn't seem to be much juice to fight the Republicans for Medicare for All or even state-based single-payer plans. So what's your strategy to get this back on the front burner and to get people passionate about it?
Well, what you're alluding to is that our political process is as broken up as our healthcare process for the same reason. It's mostly about money. And what we have to do is we have to keep educating the public so that they understand some of the subtleties of the reality of our healthcare non-system. I actually call it a sick care non-system. And And an AP poll just came out today that was done by Stanford along with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And as it turns out, 40% of Americans think the health care reform bill didn't go far enough. Twice as many as the number that thought it went too far. And then 30% don't really know, which is probably a healthy place to be at some point. But 40% of Americans are out there saying we haven't fixed it yet.
You know, it's really interesting because I take your point. And what we've seen is that Bill Maher last night had this right-wing crackpot, Andy Breitbart, the guy who does these trick videos to shut down Acorn and got that woman in Georgia in trouble. And he was spouting this figure, 70% are against Obamacare. And I screamed back at the TV, that's a misleading figure because, number one, it's not Obamacare. It's a mishmash of the pharmaceutical companies and the, you know, for-profit medical and the insurance companies that have cobbled together a bill that really worked for them, that gives them huge government subsidies and does expand coverage, but at great cost and still leaves a lot of people out. So it's a very misleading figure to say 70% are against, because what you just told us is that more than half of those people are against it because it wasn't good enough.
Yeah, it's not Obamacare, it's Baucus Care. The bill was written on the computer that was operated by Liz Fowler. Liz Fowler was Baucus's legislative aide. Before she had that job, she had a job as a vice president of an insurance company. The person whose job she took went back to the insurance industry. This bill was written by the insurance industry. And yes, it does a few good things. A few more people get covered, a few more children get covered.
But it doesn't have safeguards or enforcement mechanisms. So we're seeing that just as the coverage for children kicks in, insurance companies are saying, we're not going to write the coverage.
Correct. It does a few. And the other thing is we still don't have a health care system. We've got a sick care non-system, and to the extent that it's designed to service the insurance industry.
Mm-hmm. So where's your road trip taking you, and what kind of reaction are you getting?
We had almost 250 people packing the Bayside Grange in Arcata two nights ago, and last night we were in Santa Rosa, and this weekend we're going to be in Berkeley and San Jose, and then we're going to go to Palo Alto and Stanford and Santa Cruz and San Luis Obispo and south all the way to San Diego and then up I-5 to have a final rally in Sacramento on the doorsteps of the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. So with California broke, this, you know, Austrian-born action movie star drove us off a cliff. What do you see as a path forward? You may not know our budget details, you know, in all the richness of it, but how do you see us persuading people that there would be a net savings if we go forward into a single-payer program?
Single-payer is the fiscally responsible thing to do. If we look at all of the money we're spending on health care, including the health insurance premiums, out-of-pocket expenses, tax dollars that are already going into health care, we're spending twice as much as the rest of the industrialized world, and we're getting poor results. The idea behind single payer is you pool all that money, you get rid of the middleman that doesn't add anything to the quality of the product, and you can actually save 20 to 25% of all those dollars, which can be used to actually take care of people instead of servicing the insurance industry. It's the fiscally responsible thing to do. Now, some of the money we're going to be spending is going to look like tax dollars, whereas before it wasn't tax dollars. But it's the same money, and we get more product for the amount of money that we're spending. And the product should be health and the alleviation of suffering, and not insurance company profits. Now, getting rid of the insurance companies is not sufficient. It's the first necessary step to having a system so we can deal with the other sort of perverse incentives that drive up healthcare costs. And some of that has to do with physicians. I'm afraid the physician community is far more culpable in this than anybody's willing to talk about. And the question is, where have they been in this healthcare reform debate? Missing in action because physicians work in the heart of the dragon, and a lot of specialists are making $500,000, $600,000 $1,000 a year while our primary care doctors are withering, making a fraction of that, and you can't have a healthcare system without a strong, vibrant primary care. And that's what we're going to do when we get our single risk pool. I actually prefer to talk about single risk pool than single payer. Put everybody into the same pot.
Gotcha.
Same rules. That's where the savings are.
Now, Paul, I want to state for the record that you guys, you doctors, were mad as hell before Glenn Beck fired up the nuts and before Sarah Palin talked about death panels and got a lot of people crazy about that. And so one of the things that just bugs the hell out of me is that you have legitimate anger. The media doesn't cover that. Instead, three people who say Tea Party get 10 cameras and get 20 minutes of coverage. So how do we fix that? Because it really is frustrating that the legitimate anger on the left of this issue is totally ignored.
There's a difference in anger and rage. We talk about that in our presentations. Anger is a normal adult human emotion that people feel when they see injustice and wrong behavior. Rage is what the Tea Party people are doing, and they cut off debate, and it's not helpful. And so how do you... This is a failure of media.
Mm-hmm.
This is a terrible failure of media.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Paul.
All
great
right.
to talk with you.
Thank you.
We're here with Marin County Supervisor Susan Adams. Full disclosure, I helped her get reelected this year. Susan, you're a nurse. You have a doctorate. You used to teach right here at Dominican University. What do we do to get single payer back on track and to get people to realize that it's the best way to deliver health care services?
Well, I think that probably about two-thirds of this country is there in terms of our broken health care system. And I think there was a great deal of hope and expectation that our federal government would get it right. It was unfortunate that we watched it devolve over the course of all of the lobbying from the special interests. The health insurance industry is not interested in having a single-payer system for obvious reasons. And until we get to that place where our European brothers and sisters are having a single-payer, not-for-profit system of health care and spending anywhere from two-thirds to half of what we spend for our health care and have a longer life expectancy and less morbidity than we do in this country, I think we just have to persist and keep going, and eventually it'll happen.
And what do you see, what do people need to focus on at the state level, at the federal level?
Well, just like with other initiatives, when there's leadership at the state level and you start building critical mass, then the feds finally have to listen. And I think that Senator Leno has been courageous in continuing the fight and carrying the standard that Senator Sheila Kuehl had lifted for us. And there will be more to follow, and we'll just keep pushing until we get us over the finish line on this one. It's the right thing to do. Healthcare should be a right, not a privilege.
We have two big obstacles. One is the noise machine that calls this socialism, and the other is the way the state governments are broke. And I consider that to be artificial in a lot of ways because of the way they've blocked any reasonable tax increases. But that is the context that we have right now. So is this a 3 to 5 year effort?
Well, I don't know how many years of an effort, but until they put me in the ground, I'm going to keep working on it. This is definitely a fight worth fighting for. The artificialness that you talk about with the finances, we spend so much more on end-stage care when people aren't getting the upfront prevention and treatment than we would if we actually redirected our funds to keeping people healthier for longer. And until we wake up and realize that that's the better approach to our healthcare system. As an example, you know, you can get a small pill for about a nickel to prevent your blood pressure from giving you a stroke. Yet if you have your stroke and you end up having to go into institutionalized care, your quality of life, your ability to be independent are no longer there for you. And as a healthcare professional, we see this all the time. People who have the experience of being costed out of insurance or find finding an inexpensive insurance, but then not having the ability to find a provider who will accept that insurance. So you can have all the insurance in the world, but if you don't have a provider that takes it, you essentially have no health care. I think here in Marin County, we're doing it right. We built a wonderful new health and wellness campus that provides comprehensive services on sliding scale. So anybody who is without insurance or who is low income, who can't find a provider who will take their Medicaid or Healthy Families program, has a medical home. And that's really important, the whole concept of finding a medical home where your health care needs can be addressed.
Can we keep this a secret here in Marin and make sure Sarah Palin doesn't find out?
if Sarah Palin had the opportunity to really investigate the amount of money that could be saved with implementing a system of care that utilizes our resources more efficiently, she might even convert.
Susan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
State Senator Mark Leno is here with the Mad as Hell Doctors. Great to see you, Mark.
It's always good to see you. Thank you.
Now, you're continuing the fight for single payer in Sacramento against some tough odds. Tell us what the path forward is to really persuade people that this is the most cost-effective and fair way to deliver health care, and that it's in the best interest of a bankrupt state.
Well, you have said it all, and of course, I've always thought that our bill, which we knew, had we got it through the Assembly this year, would have met its third veto. And reporters would ask me, so why are you doing this? It's certain to be vetoed. And my comment is, well, I'm speaking to you, aren't I? And your readers will read about this tomorrow because of the fact of the bill. Without a bill, it's all conjecture. The bill makes it real. And it allows for debate. It allows for reporting. It allows for an educational process because that's really what we're in the midst of. It is literally within the power of the voters of California to say to the insurance industry, thank you very kindly. We're going to do this on our own now. But to get there, we have to be able to surmount a $200, $300, $500 million misinformation campaign, either through a referendum, which they would initiate should we get a governor to sign our bill, or if we can't get the governor's signature, through an initiative process which the insurance industry and the status quo would fight once we take it to the ballot. So either way, the voters have the final word in California on this issue, as with just about every other issue of importance.
Now, my preferred candidate for governor, Jerry Brown, seems a little coy on this issue. Has he taken a position on single payer?
Well, I think we all remember that when he ran for president of the United States in 1992, he wanted single payer for the entire country. So he is very familiar with the issue. He knows how it works. Conversations I've had with him relative to our bill and his potential support as governor was all around the financing, and I haven't had the chance to sit down with him. He wants to see in hard numbers how this can work and will not cost California anything. Of course, we can show them quite readily that it will save billions of dollars even in the first year, and that the longer we put it off, the higher the cost will go.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly are inspiring, Mark. You've moved a few mountains in your time, marriage equality being one of them, so thanks for staying on this.
Not going anywhere. The more I'm involved with this issue, the more deeply certain am I that the only way to contain costs, the only way to reform the system, is to do the obvious. Remove the for-profit middleman, which provides absolutely no health care whatsoever and only makes its multi-billions in profits by denying us health care. Makes no sense whatsoever.
Profits based on misery.
Yes, that's it.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, thank you.
Will Durst is here with the Mad as Hell Doctors in San Rafael today. Hey, Will.
Hey, how you doing, Peter B?
Thanks a lot for your new commentaries. I'm getting great response from my listeners on them.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, they're fun to do, and I'm glad there's a forum to do them at. Yeah.
So you cook these up in the bathroom, or?
Pretty much, yeah. I throw a towel over my head, over my computer, and I create a studio, Insta studio, yeah.
Yeah. So what's your take on the battle over single payers? Is this going to be like a 20-year struggle?
You know, you listen to Jimmy Carter, and he says that Teddy Kennedy was the problem, and that was, what, 34 years ago, you know, minimum. So it might be another 34 years. But I guess when they talk about incremental growth, you know, you know, what Obamacare, what we have now, is a little better than what we had before, and, you know, just one more rung on the ladder is what I'm thinking.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was watching Bill Maher last night, and Andy Breitbart was there, who's this right-wing provocateur with the special effects videos that brought down Acorn, and, you know, he got in trouble for the video he clipped on that woman in Georgia. But he was tossing out this number that 70% are against Obamacare. Well, 40% of those people are against it because it's not good enough. It didn't go far enough. But they never mention that, and they try to talk about repealing it except for the really good bits. So how do we play this? How do we play against these people who don't tell the truth and will really say anything to paint it as socialism to try to stop it?
You just keep telling people what the truth is and just keep burning it into their retina and their brain and imprinting it on their DNA, just like the other side is trying to do, you know, with the fright, with the scare tactics, you know. So I think that's the only thing. And then tell people, well, are you willing to take your kid off your insurance policy? Are you willing to let kids with previous diagnoses be, you know, barred from having insurance? And then you just mention each of the programs, and I think their resistance will wilt a bit.
What about the Frenchophobia? When you talk about European systems, that ends up being derided, but, you know, it costs less, it's more efficient, and people live longer.
Yeah. People are dumb. They just want to be angry. And it's the economy. You know, if the economy were better, people would have a better outlook about everything. I think one of the reasons that Obama or the Democrats rose 10 points in the polls, I mean, because they had a Gallup poll that showed Obama or the Democrats, if you're going to vote in November, you know, and Republicans had a 10% lead over Democrats. And then next week, it was even. So 10-point swing in a week, and I think that was because of Glenn Beck going to the Lincoln Memorial and reclaiming the civil rights movement for loud, pudgy, angry white guys. And I think a lot of it had to do with sending the kids back to school. People didn't feel like, you know, they were so closed in, and because kids can be budget busters, you know, and you put them back to school and everything settles down a little bit. So, I mean, we don't know, you know, maybe if Washington Nationals win the World Series, you know, everybody in D.C. will be happy.
So are the crazies good for your business as a humorist and satirist?
Yes, yes. Christine O'Donnell is wonderful for what I do.
Let me check your hands. Don't touch yourself there.
Yeah, she's an odd duck, you know. She's starting to make Sarah Palin look like Elena Kagan. So it's nice when they roll out these easy targets for me. And I'm hoping that, you know, she continues. You know, put her back in the talk show circuit, because they threw the muzzle on her right away.
Yeah, she's in the Sarah Palin bubble.
Yeah, with the witches and the masturbation. She brought witchcraft and masturbation into the national conversation in a week. I mean, what other jewels, you know, are waiting out there for us.
Yeah. We'll keep them coming. Great to see you.
Thank you, Peter Reed. Keep them running.
All right.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. And recently, the New York Times reported that there are now 44 million Americans living in poverty. That's 1 in 7 American residents. And the figures are recent from 2009. And it's an increase of 4 million from the year before. This occurs against the backdrop of amplified, angry rich people calling for cuts in government spending at the federal and state level, irrespective of the impact on the most vulnerable Americans. In a moment, we'll be joined by Gwendolyn Mink. But I want to take you back to the LBJ years, when people actually started to care about poverty and we started to keep records. And there was an attempt to deal with the problem called LBJ's War on Poverty. And when you fast forward to 2010, you have to ask about the poor. Does anyone give a damn?
If you train with me uptown through the misery of ghetto streets in morning light. They're always night.
Take a window seat, put down your times. You can read between the lines. Just meet the faces that you meet beyond the window's pane. And it might begin to teach you how to give a damn about your fellow man. And it might begin to teach you how to give a damn about your fellow man. Your girl to sleep sometime with rats instead of nursery rhymes, with hunger and your other children by her side, and wonder if you'll share your bed with something else that must be fed, for fear may lie beside you, or it may sleep down the hall. And it might begin to teach you
That's Spanky and Our Gang from about 1969. Gwendolyn Mink is co-editor of the two-volume Poverty in the United States, an encyclopedia of history, politics, and policy, and also the author of Welfare's End. Wendy Mink, thanks for joining us today on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Hi, happy to join you.
Do you have any familiarity with that song? Did you ever hear that?
I do recall. It plucked some memory strings there as I listened to it, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Well, this is something that really strikes me because it's been almost 10 days as we speak now since this report was issued, and it really drew one-day coverage and yawns from the ruling class and the pundit class in this country.
Yes, very few people paid attention beyond that first day, and that first day of attention wasn't particularly deep. People wanted to sort of quickly change the subject to issues that speak more broadly to middle class interests or to the tax cut question, rather than talking about why it is so many Americans are living in poverty, and so many Americans who are living in poverty are actually living in extreme poverty on less than $9,000 a year.
Yeah, and it's stunning as we see overpaid news anchors, some with a liberal bent, debate these, you know, the wisdom of continuing tax cuts for the rich, and even for the middle class. You know, that's not even discussable. And the middle class is now defined as up to $250,000 a year for a family. And this really turns the whole discussion on its ear. So I'd like to take a moment here and ask you to delve into the data just a little bit and give my listeners a sense of the extent of the expansion of poverty in recent years.
Well, the poverty increase between 2008 and 2009 was the largest jump in poverty since 1980. So it's a 30-year record that we have just witnessed. We have the largest number of people in poverty, more than 44 million in poverty, since poverty statistics have been kept, and that's in 51 years. So 45 million people in poverty, 50 million people are uninsured in terms of health provision, which is yet another measure of the scope of the problem. All of this for a poverty rate of 14.3%. 6.3% of Americans are in extreme poverty, which is really a stunning statistic. Not 6.3 of the 14.3%, but 6.3 of all Americans.
Mm.
So that's almost half of the folks living in poverty are living in extreme poverty. And extreme poverty is defined as half the poverty line. The poverty line for a family of three is $17,000 a year. So it's $8,500 a year or below that many families are having to endure. This is not an income that permits making ends meet, makes it very difficult for children and families to be adequately nourished and clothed and sheltered and sent to school. So, you know, it's something that this country should be pretty seriously concerned about and embarrassed about, frankly. If we look beneath the large aggregate numbers, the inside the 44 million and inside the 14.3%, we also have to notice the pockets of disproportionate poverty in our population. People of color are much more likely to be poor than white non-Hispanic Americans. Single mother families, the poverty rate is 38.5%. That's an enormous rate of poverty in part of our population. If we look at single mother families headed by women of color, the poverty rate approaches 50%. 46% of Latina single mother families are living in poverty, for example. And that means huge numbers of children, a third of Latina children and a third of African American children are growing up in poverty, according to this data. This is a scale of desperation and want and lack of security that really ought not to exist in a country as rich as ours.
And Wendy, in my introduction, I talked about the amplified voices of rich, and I would add white people, that we hear and see in the corporate media these days. And here in California, we have two wealthy candidates. Carly Fiorina wants to be a United States senator. She has no political experience. And we have Meg Whitman, also a novice, who is trying to buy the governorship here. And in each case, they are cynically calling their opponents instigators of class warfare. And Fiorina in particular is attacking Senator Boxer right now because a Boxer has raised issues about Fiorina's yachts and corporate jets and her failure as a CEO, which she claims as her central credential. And then we have Meg Whitman, who is running a radio commercial saying that she wants to boost funding for the University of California, which is certainly a worthy goal, by cutting welfare payments and imposing what she says is a new 2-year limit. Well, we know that federal welfare payments were reduced and time limited by the a very bad piece of legislation championed by Bill Clinton in the mid-90s. And so it's amazing that against this backdrop of extreme poverty and hardship, really that you know hasn't been seen since the 1930s in this country, that the messages that people get in the media are from wealthy people who are decrying the budget deficits and blocking any effort to raise taxes to address these central issues. And what I really feel is missing is any strong advocacy for the poor coming from what used to be a Democratic Party that addressed the interests of the lesser classes in the United States.
Well, I completely agree with your assessment. The Democrats largely abandoned low-income people in terms of the main sort of themes of their discourse in the 1990s, when they embraced the championship of the middle class. Now, it shouldn't be either or, but it seems that the Democrats' embrace of the middle class has come at the expense of the poor, both rhetorically and in terms of the kinds of policies that the party has generally been willing to put on the front burner and advocate and push for. And as a result, we have a shriveling public assistance system. Only 30% of TANF, that's Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, only 30% of TANF funds actually goes to a cash benefit for low-income families. And that's a very paltry amount of federal and state investment in making it possible for families to pay the rent and pay for food and pay for clothing and shelter. you know, and these sorts of issues certainly should be on the top of the agenda, but more often than not, I'm afraid both by Republicans and Democrats, but clearly more so by Republicans, what becomes the favored whipping boy during campaign season, both in good times and in bad, is to attack welfare and to insist on cuts and to explain deficits on the grounds that too much money is going to people who, quote unquote, don't deserve it. So yes, you've pointed to a very severe kind of gap in our national dialogue and consciousness.
And Wendy, in this past year, the Democrats have fought for the unemployed, and I want to give them a couple of points for that. Against this constant obstructionism of the Republicans, who want to declare, they basically are lumping unemployed people together with welfare recipients and defining them all as lazy, taking a handout, you know, feeling entitled to a government subsidy. And it's very important to distinguish that the unemployed and the extension of unemployment benefits are really people who've paid into an insurance fund during the times that they've been working. And there should be no argument over extending those benefits to people who are unable to find work right now. But it's even worse that the Democrats have not found any desire to fight, even to fight and lose, for those who are facing termination of welfare benefits, to those who are seeing cutbacks in food stamp and other subsidy programs. We see that public housing is the projects that were built in the 1960s and 1970s have crumbled, and the federal subsidies to build new housing units are essentially non-existent. And so the pressure on the poorest in our country is only continuing to grow, and yet we don't hear their voices. We hear the voices of angry, rich white people.
Well, you know, lots of poor people are organized. Lots of people who have participated in the TANF system are organized, but they're not covered by the media. And that's a, you know, so it's not that the voices aren't being raised.
Mm-hmm.
The voices are in many locations being raised, but they're not being, you know, sort of shared through media vehicles with the broader population to awaken the consciousness of the majority of the electorate so that pressure can be put on our policymakers to make the correct changes. You know, one of the first things that should have been on the agenda in, you know, January of 2009 was to lift the time limits in the federal welfare program. You just mentioned people getting squeezed off of the rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had the time limits been lifted, at least for the duration of the recession, many more people would be served, and many more people, as a result of receiving benefits, would be raised at least to the poverty level, if not a little bit above it. You know, part of the reason that the poverty numbers are so stark is that the kind of actual income support, cash support, for families that has been available in the 60s and 70s and even through part of the 1980s is gone. And, you know, only a third of families who are eligible for TANF are able to get it. There's a massive diversion practice that happens at the state and local level to get people not to enroll in the first place.
Right.
And so, you know, there are administrative problems, there are rules problems, all of which are a result of a policy being constructed out of a bias against the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and unfortunately that bias against the poor continues to win people votes, or so they think. And it's a hard road to get to a change.
Mm-hmm. And just in ballpark terms, Wendy, I recall looking at these issues carefully about 15 years ago. And what was stunning, as the legacy of Ronald Reagan and the image of welfare queens continued to fester, what I saw at the time was that somewhere in the range of 62% of welfare and food stamp recipients were white Americans. Yet the images of inner city African Americans and other people of color What is the current breakdown, just in ballpark terms, if you don't have a specific figure, of the ethnicity? You did point out the high numbers of people in poverty from communities of color, but flip that for me, if you would.
In terms of, I can't give you the statistics on welfare participation right now, but it's been historically about, I'd say, maybe 50% white and 50% people of color combined. And that reflects the distribution of poverty. Actually, if you look at the current poverty numbers, people of color are less likely than would be their due, given the distribution of poverty, to receive public benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing to point out is that, you know, in all of this sort of assault on people not deserving income assistance that you just sort of went through, yet another group is about to be thrown into the mix, and that's the elderly receiving Social Security. You know, we have Alan Simpson, who's co-chair of the Deficit Commission that President Obama set up, calling on elderly people to go back to work instead of sucking at the tits of the federal government and securing their old age benefits. But if you look at the statistics that the Census Bureau released last week with respect to poverty, the only demographic group that actually saw a decrease in poverty between 2008 and 2009 were seniors. And that's really testimony to the success of the Social Security program in sort of creating a baseline economic security, income security program for that demographic population.
And the two phony barriers that the Simpson-Bowles Commission is operating within are A, you cannot cut defense spending. That's off the table. And B, that you can cut Social Security, when the simple fix for solvency of Social Security is to raise the ceiling. Everybody knows
the wage cap, yeah.
Yeah, that you only pay Social Security, FICA, on the first, it's about $100,000, a little bit under that right now. And so the so-called middle class that goes up to $250,000, as it's currently defined, is getting a holiday on the bulk of its income. And if we simply remove that cap or took it up to $200 or $250, we could easily fund Social Security for my generation, the baby boomers, and maintain this safety net for the foreseeable future. And instead, we have these artificial constraints that require us to address cutbacks in Social Security and Medicare. And it's just infuriating because it is so unfair, and it's a violation, I believe, of the contracts that we have with American citizens. I've been working for 30 years, and I've been paying into Social Security, and I expect to get my fair share upon retirement. And Alan Simpson, who's got a really nice government retirement package and was wealthy before he went to the Senate, he's going to be, and Erskine Bowles is a Democrat, but a very wealthy
same thing.
Himself. These wealthy guys are going to decide the future for all Americans.
Yes, well, I mean, there's a hope that, of course, they won't be actually making that decision for all Americans, and that their plans will either die in the commission or not get very far once the commission has released its report in December or January. But, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. The Social Security question, to the extent that there are issues some, 30 years from now with respect to the amount of money in the trust fund in relation to demand from the boomer generation, those sorts of questions are actuarial and accounting questions that can be resolved through such tweaks as raising the wage cap for current workers for the FICA tax. Absolutely. The other part of the issue is that there's been this conflation of the sort of relatively minor sort of accounting issues inside Social Security with the deficit. But Social Security is a self-paying program. It was in the 1980s in particular, there were all kinds of sort of interventions to make sure that it would be a self-financing program.
Mm-hmm.
It does not drain the, it's not a general revenue program. It's paid for by FICA. So, you know, the deficit is created by spending and misspending out of general revenues. So Social Security really has nothing to do with it directly.
But Wendy, what
it's a deficit, but it's been sort of made the bugbear of the deficit reduction
now,
process.
Now, I fully agree with you there. The one component that I'm not updated on is the extent to which we keep borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund to help cover the operating deficits that we're running.
Well, it's bonds, right?
Mm-hmm.
The trust fund. The money in the trust fund, rather than simply sitting like money under a mattress, has been invested in government bonds,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, if you want to bet on the fact that the government bonds will not be whatever it is you do at the end of the bond period, you know, that they won't be supportable when
yeah.
they come due,
uh-huh.
Then yes, of course, there's a problem. But that would, you know, that would mean that there's a general insolvency in the entire, you know, capitalist American
right.
system.
Yeah. Well, Wendy, just finally, in closing here, you spoke that there are people, pardon me, in poverty, and those who advocate for them who are raising their voices. The media don't cover them. NBC just launched a new comedy show about people whose jobs are offshored.
I saw that, Outsourced or something like that.
I haven't seen it, and I've just heard about it secondhand, but it seems to be a new low in class humor and class warfare.
Absolutely.
In this country. But this is contrasted with the scene in France today, where Sarkozy is trying to raise the retirement age 2 years from 60 to 62, and there are millions of people in the streets. And I feel that we really need to get active on economic issues. I'm also concerned about our military policies and the incredible spending that we place there. But it really seems that we need to rally people and speak up, speak out, and protest strongly, if only to get the Democratic Party to pay attention. And, you know, the real dark prospect is that if the Republicans take control of the House and Senate, that they would be far worse. The benign neglect of Democrats is something that I can't countenance. But it would be far worse if Republicans can cut these programs even further and drive a greater wedge between the wealthy and the rest of us in this country.
Absolutely. I hope that when they start talking about raising the retirement age again, that as many people take to the streets in this country as have done in Paris.
Well, Wendy, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I appreciate your work. Gwendolyn Mink is a co-editor of the two-volume Poverty in the United States and also the author of Welfare's End. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And speaking of angry rich people and class warfare, our official movie reviewer, Gary Chu, has screened Oliver Stone's new film, Wall Street Never Sleeps. Let's check it out.
Oliver Stone must be growing timid approaching Social Security age. Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, his sequel to Gordon Gekko's 23-year-old allegiance to greed is goodism, only ruffles the feathers of American high finance and casino capitalism. As our story opens, Gekko's being released from an 8-year run in the joint. He has a 2-day beard, no one's at the gate, but wait, Gordon is sporting a very cool high-dollar Hollywood man cut. Mercy, it's Gordon Gekko with hair just like Michael Douglas's. Sing Sing has great hairstylists. Who knew? Gekko, soon back at the heart of Finance City, meets a young Wall Streeter named Jacob, played by Shia LaBeouf. He's pumped for green energy profiteering, apparently to give the picture a sense of hope. And Gordon appears to be downshifting into a redemptive gear, what with writing his first book, Is Greed Good? And, oh yes, selling it at a healthy price. Jacob is also bunking with Gekko's daughter, Winnie, played by Carey Mulligan. She's demurred contact with Daddy since her brother's suicide. Dad not only scams people big time, but causes his male offspring to do himself in, is what's running through Winnie's hip, pretty head. The business built by Lewis, Jacob's mentor, collapses. The elderly Wall Streeter, played by Frank Langella, takes a swan dive in front of an oncoming subway. Lewis's brokerage house is patterned after the real demise of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers in March 2008 during the final year of President Bush's second term. Replacing Javier Bardem in the role of Breton, Josh Brolin plays a hedge fund manager. Bardem instead went to eating, praying, and loving with Julia Roberts. Breton has evidently floated rumors that have thrown Lewis's firm into the financial breach, driving Lewis to the drastic act. If that's not enough to get tempers flaring and plot twists twirling, are you in for a surprise? Yes, a surprise all right. To find that Money Never Sleeps is quite a ponderous and uneven movie that plays like three old Dynasty TV episodes, strung together but with all the update dots connected since the 08 money problems kicked in. I can see a new TV series already. The Carringtons meet the Madoffs. Electrifying. Stone occasionally goes nutty with graphic and visual effects seemingly employed to goose the pace and give Wall Street 2 a zip of youthful I'll-get-mine-ism. Yep, Money Never Sleeps and the cameras never still, especially around big boardroom tables with key people at them discussing how much bailout money they can get from the Fed. You know, socialism. Maybe the reason for the visual mobility is the way Alan Loeb and Stephen Schiff wrote the dialogue. Well-crafted words for a film don't need an acrobatic camera to make them work. Never sleeps, never fails to assail with strings of financial ease which only your friendly neighborhood hedge fund manager can translate. Verbal authenticity is neat, you betcha, but when applied to a host of acquisitive, arrogant professionals ensconced along Wall Street in a narrative that wants you to primarily appreciate the now anti-hero nature of a high-toned ex-con scam artist who just maybe has come around to decency, esoteric language to make it real has little impact. Another thing, the music in the movie is awful. None of it fits, like it has a hidden agenda. Other than Mr. Douglas, whom I wished the very best with his recently announced medical issue, the casting is uneven, too. LaBeouf looks underage and tenuous as Jacob, showing sparks of the brave new capitalist only in scenes with male colleagues. Alone on screen with Mulligan, he's a wuss. Mulligan, in An Education, wowed me, but here she's not right as a sensitive, young, perceptive, rich woman because she doesn't exude the sophisticated glamour shown by other female characters in the film. Mulligan's costumes look like the music sounds. Douglas gives a stirring sell lecture for Gordo's book. He's long predicted the 08 financial quake and its aftershocks now shivering the Obama White House. Gordo's spiel underscores the notion there is no Gordon Gekko without Michael Douglas. Josh Brolin's Breton is a shinier example of casting. Appropriately oleaginous, Breton vies to replace Gekko as villain, while Susan Sarandon, as Jacob's real estate lady mom, makes brief penetrating turns with an Eastern-accented rich lady dialect. It's good, but she, as in The Lovely Bones, seems forced. Money Never Sleeps could be more intense if, during the moments when the New York people are on the phone pleading bailout from the D.C. feds, Stone would have also shown the D.C. side of that chat, giving up the identity of those characters, too, even if all the names were changed to protect the innocent. There's a bunch of reviews by the guy with this voice at TulsaTVMemories.com or on the International Movie Database, IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu, down in the valley.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Send me an email with your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.